to most of us, that's simply the sound of a crying baby. But to that baby's parents, it also means, I'm hungry, or I'm sleepy, or please get out of bed and change my diaper now. Well, the makers of a new iPhone application claim that it, too, can interpret the subtle differences in a baby's cries. It's called the Cry Translator. It sells for $9.99. That's fairly expensive, as apps go. And the baby we just heard belongs to one of our producers, Melissa Gray. She joins me now to put this Cry Translator to the test. Hey, Melissa.
Hey, I could have used this one about 6 months ago, I think.
Well, let's play that cry again. This is your son, Thomas. Melissa, it hurts just to hear that.
Yes.
I'm so sorry. That is Thomas, and the iPhone app is telling me hungry.
Mm-mm. No.
You say no.
Mm-mm. No, no. That is his where are you? I'm lonely. Get in here now cry.
Well, you were standing right there with a microphone.
I was the microphone was in there with him, and I was down the hall watching.
He said, what's this strange metallic object next to my crib? The iPhone app, which thinks Thomas is telling you he's hungry, is telling me to view suggestions for hungry. And there's a disclaimer. Not going to be responsible for the effectiveness of the consequences of using the fourth written advice to calm the baby. Here are the suggestions for you, Melissa, mom, okay, from the Cry Translator. Offer infant a bottle or try breastfeeding. You can offer the baby age-appropriate baby food if recommended by a pediatrician or family doctor. Useful information if your child is hungry.
I wouldn't have known.
Yeah, that's why you need a $9.99 iPhone app. Well, let's try another cry. I guess Thomas has a range of cries. We're going to hear another one. And let's see if the iPhone app does any better this time. Now, Melissa, Thomas clearly has a lot he's trying to tell you there. If I had to guess, I think he's telling you, I'm bored. Play with me.
No, that is poopy diaper. Get in here.
He doesn't seem to be that upset about it.
No, he is upset. That's his angry. You can hear a combination. When he gets frustrated, he does a lot of snorting, kind of like a little piglet. And he's angry because the diaper's full and I haven't changed him.
Well,
and I'm standing here with a microphone.
You want to know what the cry translator is?
Yes, I'm very curious.
They think Thomas is sleepy.
Oh, so no.
All wrong. The cry translator is 0 for 2.
Imagine if you were trying to raise your kid based on the application.
Let's
here.
Hope you have some other instincts that kick into gear. Melissa, thanks for testing this out with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's our producer, Melissa Gray, and her son, Thomas, demonstrating his various cries. If you want to know more about the Cry Translator app, we have blogged about it at npr.org/alttech. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Now to the business of selling printer ink. It's competitive and lucrative. Ounce for ounce, printer ink can be more expensive than vintage champagne or Russian caviar, which explains why ink companies spend a lot of time clamping down on counterfeits. Christian Foden-Wenzel of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports on one legal battle involving dark allegations of corporate espionage.
Have you ever wondered why printer ink is so expensive? Companies like Epson and Hewlett-Packard sell their printers relatively cheap, and then they rely on the sales of replacement cartridges to bolster profits. But as Oregon shoppers Scott Davis and Alicia Gale illustrate, it's a business model that doesn't sit well with some consumers.
Computer cartridges, the ink, it's just way too expensive. It's ridiculous.
Every time I go to buy a new cartridge, it's $40, $50.
Does that seem like a good deal to you?
No, it's very expensive.
But Tricia Judge, with the International Imaging Technology Council, says it's the same way people have bought razors for years. The original razor is relatively cheap, but replacement blades are expensive.
It's a fair way of doing business, and companies have used it for years.
But given the expense, it's easy to understand why dozens of companies have sprung up to provide cheap toner refills. What they do is snap off the top of the old printer cartridge, fill them up, snap the cap back on, and then sell them. It's all perfectly legal. What courts disagree about is whether U.S. patent law applies when the original toner cartridge is purchased overseas. In April, Epson filed suit against several companies complaining they were doing just that. One of those companies, Green Project, is headed by Joseph Wu. He's adamant his company doesn't collect cartridges abroad, and what's more, he's filing a countersuit against Epson. He claims Epson has been spying on his company. It all started, according to Wu, when a man identifying himself as Casey Wells turned up at a Green Project trade show booth. He was asking some pretty technical questions. A few weeks later, Wells phoned, asking for a sales package and price list. Then, Wu claims, he turned up at Green Project, but not at the front door.
He has snuck through the back door of our warehouse and into our warehouse.
Wu claims he recognized the man as Casey Wells from the trade show and was immediately suspicious.
I asked him, I was like, Casey, you know, I believe you work for Epson. You know, do you work for Epson? And of course, he would deny it. You know, he said, no, I don't work for Epson. I just want to buy from you guys and, run my business.
When Wells left, Wu says he searched the internet for his business. There was nothing. But the world of replacement printer cartridges is small. And word on the street was that Epson had an investigator called Herbert Seitz. So he looked for a picture of Seitz on the web. And when he found one, he says he recognized Seitz right away.
In that picture is a picture of Casey Wells. And at that point, honestly, it just hit me. You know, I was like, wow, you know, I can't believe, number one, that Epson sent a spy into our business. And number two, I can't believe I was able to tie this together to find out who he is.
NPR made several attempts to reach Herbert Seitz and Casey Wells through calls, emails, and registered letters, all with no success. In a written statement, Epson's public relations office said, quote, "As is common to protect intellectual property rights, Epson conducted a reasonable investigation using legally acceptable measures." The company also added that claims like Green Projects are frequently asserted in countersuits to patent infringement cases. Jim Crown, the director of the American Intellectual Property Law Association, says it's true that defendants like Green Project will use all kinds of legal maneuvers.
Certainly a defendant would probably look for any and every opportunity to deflect the charge that was being made. It's not the kind of thing that I would see on a regular basis, but it's not surprising that a defendant might raise it.
In California, where the alleged spying took place, licensed private detectives are supposed to carry ID cards and identify themselves. The California Bureau of Security has opened an investigation into the case. For NPR News, I'm Christian Fodenvenzel in Portland.
As Americans think about their Afghan strategy, Saudi Arabia is thinking about its own future and about the way Saudis think. It's opened a brand new university, already one of the wealthiest in the world. The King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, known as KAUST, has an endowment of $10 billion. It's trying to be an oasis of academic freedom in a very traditional society. Kelly McEvers reports.
The university opened to great fanfare in late September. Fireworks and a laser light show proclaimed a new era of scientific research. Here in a region where students routinely score below the international average in math and science, Arab heads of state joined Saudi King Abdullah to congratulate him on his pet project, a graduate-level institution that will research how to harness solar power, desalinate water, and genetically alter plants to survive in the harsh desert. The hope is to create millions of jobs for an exploding population and to help modernize Saudi society by going co-ed, which until now was strictly forbidden. Humanity has been the target of vicious attacks from extremists, the king said at the ceremony. Scientific centers that embrace all people are the first line of defense against these extremists. The next day, Saudi newspapers lavished praise on the king. But then, one Islamic TV channel featured a popular cleric on a call-in show. When asked about KAUST, Sheikh Sahad al-Shithri said men and women studying together is unacceptable. And he said religious scholars should review the university's curriculum to avoid what he called irregular and alien ideologies, like evolution. His comments sparked a harsh debate between reformers and religious conservatives. Jamal Khashoggi, the editor of a reformist newspaper, wrote an editorial accusing al-Shithri and his followers of trying to sabotage the opening of KAUST.
They're afraid of progress. They are afraid of what they see behind KAUST. They see a cynical plan to secularize Saudi Arabia, which doesn't exist. and they are afraid.
In the end, the sheikh was fired from his position on a council of religious scholars who advised the king. But since then, he has become a hero of sorts among conservatives. He was able to keep his teaching job at a leading Islamic university. And the reformers seem to have backed down a bit.
I'm standing outside the main gate of the Kaus campus right now. The architecture is stunning. It's unlike anything you would see in conservative Saudi Arabia. It's more like flashy Dubai, modern shapes coming out of the desert. The government invited scores of journalists to come and write about the opening of this institution. But now, since the controversy, the campus is totally off limits to journalists and outsiders. Officials say they don't want anything to interfere with the academic activity of the school.
Either way, the people at Kaust say they're thrilled to be part of the project. Leading scientists from around the world have come on 5-year contracts with annual research budgets between $400,000 and $800,000. To lure the first class of 375 students, the majority of whom are from Saudi Arabia, China, and Mexico, Kaust paid their final year of undergraduate studies and offers full tuition plus a stipend now. Nathan Ball graduated from Texas A&M and is here to study bioengineering. He blogs about experiences at Kaust, like the recent student elections. He says he knows Saudi Arabia is watching Kaust to see if such ideas can work in the larger society.
It's been really interesting to have men and women sitting in the same classrooms, because we have women who are very traditional and they wear the full abaya and even the face cover, and they're comfortable with that. And then we have women from the United States or from more Western culture who are dressing semi-conservatively with long pants and shirts that cover adequately, but everybody's comfortable in their own dress and in their own culture.
Like another student said, that's how it is in big companies, in real life. And he says that's how it could be in Saudi Arabia. For NPR News, I'm Kelly McEvers, Riyadh.
In 45 days, there will be a mob at Times Square counting down. And then what? What do we call the year that kicks in when the ball comes down? The four digits, 2010, are not in dispute, but how we say them evidently is. Is it 2010 or 2010? We've checked our own airwaves, and we find them to be, as you might expect, impeccably balanced.
Automakers are rolling out their 2010 lineup.
They actually have come out with the 2010 Chevrolet Equinox.
We'll avoid falling into the donut hole in 2010.
I wasn't going to run for anything in 2010.
Well, either impeccably balanced or perfectly evasive. We called a few people who in the course of their work are looking ahead to next year to find out what they're saying. For example, there is an election next year in Iowa, where Michael Morrow is Secretary of State.
We're always thinking about next year when it's an election year and you're in charge of the elections.
So what are you going to call next year?
I think we're going to call it 2010.
What do you call this year?
I call this year 2009. Next year, common sense-wise, it's going to start going 2010, 2011. There was a song clear back in the late 60s, and it was called The Year 2525.
I'd hate to think that that song is driving policy in the state of Iowa.
I don't think it does.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive.
Despite that invocation of common sense, we are frankly stumped as to what this song has to do with what to call next year. But it isn't the only appeal to popular culture that we heard.
My name is Jim Burke. I'm a general manager of a mail order company called The Daily Planner. We sell tens of thousands of calendars every year.
So you must have to pronounce the name of next year pretty often in the course of your work.
A zillion times a day, it feels like.
So what do you say?
We say 2010.
Why? Why not 2010?
Because probably of the movie 2001, people just got used to saying that over and over again. So when they move to each year, they're just saying 2002, 2003, all the way through.
Bob Condren has to say next year's name. He's with the U.S. Olympic Committee, and they have winter games next year.
There are games in Vancouver and Whistler starting February 12th.
February 12th?
2010. February 12th, 2010. It's going to be 2012, 2014, 2016, 2018, and then on into perpetuity.
To the year that we'll all be talking about, 2020.
2020, once you say, yeah, optometrist Olympics.
Well, Jim Lasser says 2010 just isn't the proper name of a year. It's a nickname. It's kid talk. He's the art director of Wyden and Kennedy, an ad agency in Portland, Oregon. Lasser says grown-ups should say 2010.
I think grown-ups naturally have more respect for time. I mean, grown-up people are always on time. They wear watches, and they have calendars on their wall. They always have a good idea of what time is and how important it is to be on time. So naturally, I think they would show 2010 the respect it deserves.
Sort of like calling a year Mr. or Madam. But Jim Lasser does offer this grammatical compromise.
I think when you put the year, when it's describing something like the 1985 Bears, the fiercest team ever, when the year is describing a noun, I think you can go into the truncated version. So if you said the 2010 Nike Super Shoe, like that's fine. But when you talk about the year on itself, like a noun, like a proper noun, like a person, like a citizen, it would be 2010.
As in the great 2010 controversy. What shall we call the year 2010?
And which do you prefer? You can vote at NPR's news blog, The Two-Way. Just go to npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
While President Obama is in Asia, his lieutenants at home are struggling to enact health care reform. The Senate is ready to take up the measure this week, although Republican leader Mitch McConnell warns that nobody should expect passage anytime soon.
Look, we spent 4 weeks on a farm bill in the last Congress, 8 weeks on an energy bill earlier this decade. This will be on the floor for quite a long time. I think it ought to be on the floor at least as long as it's been in Harry Reid's office.
Senator McConnell speaking on Fox News Sunday, referring there to the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Health care is just one of the issues on the political plate this week, and we're going to get a preview with NPR's Cokie Roberts, who joins us most Monday mornings. Cokie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
From the way that Senator McConnell spoke there, it sounds like we've got lots and lots and lots and lots of time to keep talking about health care.
He didn't sound terribly happy, did he? Well, there are lots of problems here, and every day another story emerges on problems that are in the House bill as people start to read through all of that language. And there are especially problems with cost. These huge Medicare savings that the bill, both bills, have talked about to pay for the health care reform. Those savings have been problematic from the beginning. And over the weekend, a report from the agency that administers Medicare and Medicaid said that the cuts could mean some hospitals and nursing homes stop taking Medicare, which would mean a reduction in benefits and access for some seniors. Congress can fix that, of course, but then the cost of the bill goes up. So this comes at the same time that fight over abortion continues. Lots of other contentious matters in this bill. So it seems to be getting harder to pass rather than easier as time goes on, and I don't think that's what most people expected.
So is the bill dead if it doesn't pass this year?
Not necessarily, but it gets a whole lot tougher. Christmas is a great deadline. It gets, it concentrates the mind, and it's a good way to pass a bill. Election years are also bad ways to pass bills, and next year, of course, is an election year. Democrats are getting more nervous about next year, especially after this week a Gallup poll came out that showed Republicans pulling ahead of Democrats in the so-called generic ballot. That's that question that which party's candidate would you vote for if the election were held today. The big problem that poll shows for Democrats is among independent voters, where the Republicans were ahead of Democrats by 22 points. Now, they were only up by 1 point in the summertime. And those independents just elected Republican governors in New Jersey and Virginia, saying that they were worried about government spending. So Democrats know they have to pay a lot of attention there.
So you're talking there about the 2010 election, but because Sarah Palin, the former vice presidential candidate on the Republican side, has a book out this week, some people will be talking and thinking about 2012.
She is out there, and you're getting all kinds of reactions to her and to the book already. The book isn't officially out until tomorrow. She will be on the Oprah Winfrey Show today and then out on tour, where thousands of people are expected to show up at her events around the country. She'll be traveling in a bus that has the picture of the book cover on it. But you're hearing lots of Republicans talking about whether she really is a standard bearer for the party. John McCain staffers, who she gets even with in the book, are not liking her so much. And conservative New York Times columnist David Brooks yesterday called her a joke. But Newt Gingrich is reminding people that Ronald Reagan was considered a joke in the early days. And there are a lot of people right now, as you well know, Steve, in economic distress. They don't like either party. They don't like politicians. They don't like the media. She gives a voice to all of that. And arguments about whether the book is factual or not don't really matter to people who are mad and like hearing someone saying things that they agree with.
But you mentioned the Democrats' trouble with independent voters. Doesn't she have the same problem with independent voters?
Yes, she does. And that's where her negatives are very high. And how she gets to a point where people take her seriously is a huge question, particularly since she's not a governor. She's not in a position to be dealing with substance. And she has to get beyond the base that's excited about her to those independent voters to be a viable candidate. We'll see if she can do that and what the next few days bring out. But it's certainly going to be interesting to watch.
Thanks very much. That's NPR's Cokey Roberts, who joins us on most Monday mornings, right here on Morning Edition from NPR News. Next, we're going to give you the dirt on dust. Even the most well-scrubbed homes will have some dust build up somewhere. And the reason to remove dust is not just aesthetic. As NPR's Joe Palca reports, dust has some potentially harmful stuff in it.
As they used to say in Elizabethan times, how dost thou? I tend to favor a vacuum. On the other hand, nature abhors a vacuum. But before we get into removing dust, let's talk a bit about what dust is and how it gets into your house.
Outdoor soil particles that come in on your shoes.
Paloma Beamer is on the faculty of the University of Arizona in Tucson and something of a dustologist. Outdoor soil is one element in dust. Another is the tiny particles in air that float in when you open a window or door. And then there's the indoor component of dust.
Like pieces of your carpet fiber or your furniture, your bedding, or anything like that starts decaying.
The indoor components also include certain bits of organic matter.
A lot of our skin flakes and dander off your pets and other insects or bugs that might be in the home.
Now, as anyone who's looked under a sofa knows, there's dense dust and there's fluffy dust.
So a lot of the fluffy things, I think, tend to do more when you get a lot of fibers. In my house, it comes from cat hair.
Beamer is interested in dust because it's one way people can be exposed to toxic substances. For example, for someone living near a toxic waste site, some of those chemicals can end up in house dust. The question is, how much? In a recent paper in the journal Environmental Science and Technology, she calculates the proportion of dust that's from indoor sources compared to outdoor.
The indoor percentage would be around 34%, and then the two-thirds from outdoor comes both from soil track-in and the outdoor air particles.
But to understand the potential for exposure, it's also crucial to understand how dust can get into your body. Turns out, for dust, size matters.
The big thing about particles and breathing particles is the size of those.
Andrea Ferro is also a dust expert. She's at Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York. She says some of the particles are small enough that they can float in the air and we can breathe them into our lungs. Others are larger and tend to sink more rapidly to the ground. One thing that's remarkable about dust is that it sticks around. Ferro says without vacuuming, it can stick around for a long time.
And we're finding things like DDT in many indoor dust samples. Well, we haven't had, we banned that decades ago, but it's still there.
In addition to breathing in dust through your nose, you can also swallow it. Duke University's Heather Stapleton is an environmental chemist. She says you may not be in the habit of licking the floors or carpets in your home, but some younger members of your household might be doing essentially that.
Being a parent of a six-month-old, I can't tell you how many times I look at my son and I see him with his hands in the mouth all the time or picking up a toy and putting it in his mouth. So
it's incredibly difficult to quantify what mass of dust they're actually exposed to and any contaminants associated with that dust, but it definitely occurs.
Stapleton says it's really hard to estimate just how much exposure a person has to the chemicals in dust. But obviously, reducing the amount of dust will reduce your exposure.
Keeping a well-dusted home, a well-vacuumed home, will reduce the dust in your home the most.
Paloma Beamer says you want to get a good vacuum, and if it has one, change the bag before it gets too full.
And it's important to remind yourself to not just vacuum your floor, but also your upholstered furniture.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Okay, more work to do.
Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Dusting the Globe. This is NPR News.